This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents SOG, The Secret Wars of America's Commandos in Vietnam by John Plaster. Read by Arthur Morey. I'd like to have two armies, one for display with lovely guns, tanks, little soldiers, staffs, distinguished and doddering generals, and dear little regimental officers who would be deeply concerned over their generals' bowel movements or their colonels' piles, an army that would be shown for a modest fee on every fairground in the country. The other would be the real one, composed entirely of young enthusiasts in camouflage uniforms who would not be put on display, but from whom impossible efforts would be demanded and to whom all sorts of tricks would be taught. That's the army in which I should like to fight. Jean Lategui, soldier and writer. 1. Colby's Secret War. It was a miserable sea, yet navigable despite the looming islands and the swells that propelled the heaving 38-foot junk. February was well into North Vietnam's monsoon season, and when there weren't full-fledged typhoons, there were squalls and showers, day after day. Wretched conditions for small craft like this junk, but people must eat, so fish must be caught. Despite the modern times, February 1961, the bobbing boat had been hand-built in the Vietnamese tradition, crafted by the very half-dozen men who manned her. Wooden-hulled and two-masted, above deck she had just a small, squarish wheelhouse aft, and like all North Vietnamese fishing boats, displayed proudly communist red sails. They were her only propulsion. And because she lacked modern navigational instruments, her captain steered as had his ancestors for 10 generations by the stars. But in tonight's overcast it was not his knowledge of the heavens, but his familiarity with the towering limestone islands around them that allowed him to steer closer to the seaside town of Cam Pha. 2 nights earlier they'd passed the glowing horizon that was Haiphong, North Vietnam's major port city, and this evening, during a quiet sunset, they could almost see the hazy mountains of Guangxi Province, China, some 40 miles northward. No other fishing boats braved tonight's squalls or teased the darkened reefs and shoals. On so miserable a night, surely no government craft could come to their rescue if they were swamped. But, on the other hand, neither would a communist Sua Tao-class patrol boat stop them and make difficult inquiries, which actually was their main concern. Despite its authentic appearance, this junk had been built not in North Vietnam, but 800 miles away at Vung Tau, South Vietnam. And while the men who made and manned her were once simple fishermen, in more recent years they'd become refugees who fled the communists, and even more recently, they'd been trained by CIA paramilitary officers who also had financed this entire expedition. When at last his junk reached calmer, leeside waters behind the jagged island, the captain called up a thin, middle-aged man from below. Several crewmen lowered over the side a small woven basket boat crammed with a radio and provisions, and off he went. Agent Ares, the CIA's first long-term North Vietnam-based operative, had been successfully landed. The man to whom Agent Ares ultimately reported was as much his opposite as was imaginable. Catholic, Ivy League, with intelligent eyes behind horn-rimmed glasses, William Colby looked and sounded more like a corporate executive than the CIA's Saigon station chief. Comfortable in a bow tie and business suit on even the sultriest tropical days, the man who oversaw this expanding covert enterprise hardly appeared to be a rising CIA star and longtime veteran of the secret wars. In 1944, then-Lieutenant William Colby had parachuted into Nazi-occupied France as one of the OSS's most elite operatives, a Jedburgh officer, to help the resistance disrupt German defenses behind the Normandy beaches. A year later, he was sabotaging Norwegian rail lines to prevent German units from reaching the Reich before its collapse, while several of his OSS colleagues became founders of U.S. Army Special Forces, Kolbe joined the new post-war civilian intelligence agency, the CIA. His career progressed steadily. Soon after Kolbe's 1959 appointment to the ever more important Saigon station, there began a troubling reappearance in South Vietnam of old communist Viet Minh fighters who had emigrated to the North in 1954 after the French Indochina War. At its April 1959 15th plenum, the North Vietnamese Communist Party Central Committee had voted in secret session to return covertly to South Vietnam thousands of such Viet Minh veterans. These infiltrators were to work with party cadres who'd remained in South Vietnam to execute a conquest intended from its inception to be deniable, and thus undercut any rationale for foreign intervention. To infiltrate on such a scale, the Central Committee created a special army unit, the 559th Transportation Group, the numbers commemorating its May 1959 founding, which in tandem with North Vietnam's Trinh Sat Secret Intelligence Service would train people and move them southward. From his headquarters in North Vietnam's Ha Tinh province, the infiltration commander, Brigadier General Vo Bam, cautioned, "This route must be kept absolutely secret." Therefore, when the first group headed south in August 1959, they wore untraceable peasant garb and carried captured French weapons. For the next 16 years, Hanoi insisted it had no role in the fighting in South Vietnam. The returning Viet Minh marched 10 miles each day among busy detachments of army engineers sent to improve and expand these simple footpaths they called the Trung Son Route, because it meandered through a similarly named mountain chain. Westerners would call this network the Ho Chi Minh Trail. CIA Station Chief Kolbe found gathering information about the Trung Son route difficult. Indeed, this landlocked Laotian wilderness was largely unmapped, with misty valleys so blanketed by jungle that flyovers and aerial photos disclosed nothing. To find what was there required putting men on the ground. The CIA recruited French coffee planters at Khe San on South Vietnam's northwest frontier to travel every few weeks along Route 9 to the quiet village of Che Pho Ne, Laos, 30 miles away. Despite keeping their eyes peeled, the planters brought back little intelligence because infiltration parties were small and crossed Highway 9 at night. The incoming Kennedy administration expanded Kolbe's covert effort to detect communist infiltration and insinuate an expanded network of CIA saboteurs and agents into North Vietnam. National Security Memorandum 52 authorized the CIA to employ Army Green Berets and Navy SEALs to train and advise the South Vietnamese who would execute Kolbe's covert missions. Technically, the Green Berets and SEALs weren't working for the CIA. They worked for CAS, an innocuous cover whose initials stood for Combined Area Studies. At the seaside resort town of Nha Trang, American Special Forces trained South Vietnamese First Observation Group commandos to explore the growing Ho Chi Minh Trail. During 1961 and 1962, the first group mounted 41 recon operations into the Laotian infiltration corridor, but its teams were too cautious to learn much. The CIA-funded mountain scouts penetrated Laos, too. However, these courageous but illiterate Montagnard tribesmen could not comprehend map reading and couldn't associate what they discovered with a recordable location. Meanwhile, in Da Nang, the SEALs trained junk crews to land secret agents in the north and organized a civilian raiding force, the Sea Commandos, for hit-and-run coastal attacks. Soon, the Sea Commandos began across-the-beach raids on North Vietnam to plant a clever weapon designed by SEAL gunner's mate Barry Enoch. Enoch rigged a packboard with four cardboard tubes, each containing a 3.5-inch anti-tank rocket wired to a delay mechanism, so a raider could slip ashore at night, aim the packboard toward, say, a radar station, activate the timer, then paddle back to a waiting boat. The raiders would be long gone by the time the North Vietnamese got their sunrise surprise. After several successes, some raider junks were intercepted by enemy Sua Thao patrol boats, whose automatic cannons and heavy 12.7mm machine guns made quick work of the flimsy wooden craft. Alosiel gunner's mate Enoch devised a host of clever junk armaments, from hidden rocket launchers to 50-caliber machine guns concealed in 55-gallon drums. It soon reached the point that junks were just too vulnerable to ply North Vietnamese waters. The CIA began a search for faster boats, and turned as well to aerial infiltration via a new South Vietnamese Air Force unit. To command the clandestine VNAF squadron that would penetrate the North, Colby sought out a flamboyant pilot with a thin Clark Gable mustache and a penchant for black flight suits. Though only 30 years old, already he was a colonel and commanded Saigon's Tan Son Nhut Air Base and seemed willing to fly anything, anywhere. But did that include piloting unmarked C-47s deep into North Vietnam? Colby asked. The pilot smiled and said, "When do we start?" The gutsy flyer eventually would head his country's air force and go on to be South Vietnam's president, Nguyen Cao Ky. Ky recruited his best pilots, but months of training would precede their first operational flight. To help them, the CIA brought in nationalist Chinese instructor pilots with hundreds of missions over mainland China very similar to what Ky's men would fly, 100 feet above the treetops at night, under 30% moonlight. CIA air experts at Thak Le, Thailand, were asked to help Colby plan the North Vietnam aerial penetrations. He couldn't have found a more capable group. Colonel Harry Heine Aderholt, likely the most experienced special operations officer in the Air Force, had just finished the CIA's Tibet airlift, where unmarked C-130s had penetrated Chinese-occupied Tibet to parachute supplies and guerrillas to the pro-Dalai Lama resistance. On loan to the CIA for secret projects since the Korean War, Aderholt's Thailand-based organization had just been redirected to support the CIA's expanding guerrilla force in Laos, using Air America planes, when the infiltration analysis job was assigned. Assisting Aderholt was probably the CIA's finest aerial infiltration planner, USAF Major Larry Ropka. Studious, intense, a perfectionist, Ropka had planned all the Tibet flights, and if not one plane was lost, it was largely because he applied his whole being to such a task. With 90% of the North's population arrayed along its coastal lowlands and Red River Valley, Major Ropka could see that any approach from the Tonkin Gulf, the front door, was certain to be met by MiGs and anti-aircraft guns. Therefore, he planned aerial infiltration routes through the less populated mountainous border with Laos, the back door, where terrain masking and electronic confusion were most effective. To improve the back door, Ropka had Air America planes in Laos climb to 5,000 feet, where they would appear on North Vietnamese radar, fly a backdoor approach, then descend to low level, below radar, and turn back to Thailand. After dozens of false alarms, the North's air defense network would stop alerting fighters and anti-aircraft units and wouldn't be able to distinguish between Ropka's feints and the real infiltration flights, which were soon to begin. Meanwhile, the agents to be inserted were being instructed at Camp Long Ton, 20 miles east of Saigon, where Green Berets and CIA officers taught them intelligence and sabotage techniques, rough terrain parachuting, weapons handling, Morse code and survival, skills to sustain them for years in North Vietnam. By late spring 1961, the graduate agents were ready to join Agent Ares, who by now was regularly tapping out Morse code messages to a CIA communications center in the Philippines. But unlike Ares, a singleton or lone operator, the new operatives would land in teams of 3 to 8 men. They would lack the luck of Ares. The first airdropped group, Team Atlas, never came up on its appointed frequency. The plane that delivered them disappeared. Colonel Key personally flew the next airdrop mission, inserting Team Castor deep in North Vietnam. 3 months later, Hanoi held a much-publicized trial for three Atlas survivors. Then Team Castor went off the air, and CIA handlers realized Teams Dido and Echo were under enemy control, so they were played as doubles. The last team parachuted into North Vietnam in 1961. Team Tarzan was presumed captured. Despite such losses, at least Colby now had an infrastructure for conducting his secret war that he could improve and build upon. But something beyond Colby's control unexpectedly came into play. 2 months after Agent Ares paddled ashore, another CIA expedition landed half a world away, in a debacle forever to be known by the name of its locale, the Bay of Pigs. The catastrophic failure of the Cuban exile landing so embarrassed President Kennedy that he appointed General Maxwell Taylor to learn what had gone wrong. The Taylor Commission concluded that the Cuba project had escalated beyond the size manageable by the CIA. It recommended a worldwide review of other CIA enterprises to learn if any had grown beyond intelligence operations, and if so, to switch them to military control. William Colby's growing secret war fit the commission's criteria perfectly. During the summer of 1962, the CIA agreed to transfer these Southeast Asian programs to the military in 18 months, dubbing it Operation Switchback. But on the very day scheduled for switchback, 1 November 1963, South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem was overthrown. Then 3 weeks later, President Kennedy was assassinated, further delaying the transfer. And the military had yet to create a unit to absorb the CIA programs. Meanwhile, Hanoi stepped up its infiltration, causing Defense Secretary Robert McNamara to order a series of covert attacks on North Vietnam to make it clear to the leaders of the North that they would suffer serious reprisals for their continuing support of the insurgency in South Vietnam. Under O Plan 34A, issued 15 December 1963, McNamara intended to send only a symbolic message limiting targets to those that provide maximum pressure with minimum risk. Despite McNamara's insistence that O Plan 34A missions commence 1 February 1964, it wasn't until 24 January that Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, MACV, finally organized the covert unit to take over the CIA programs. Soon it would be the largest clandestine military unit since World War II's OSS. Commanded by an Army colonel, it would include elements of all services, from Army Green Berets and Navy SEALs to U.S. Air Force Air Commandos, operating as SOG, the Special Operations Group, a descriptive label that made a mockery of security. A few months later, the unit was renamed, yet its acronym remained SOG. Only now, SOG stood for Studies and Observations Group, a supposed gathering of quiet analysts devoted to academic study. The Studies and Observations Group was not subordinate to MACV, or its new commander, General William Westmoreland. It answered directly to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, JCS, in the Pentagon, often with White House-level input. Only five non-SOG officers in Saigon were even briefed on its top-secret doings. Westmoreland, his Chief of Staff, his intelligence officer, J-2, the 7th Air Force Commander, and the Commander of U.S. Naval Forces, Vietnam. SOG's charter authorized operations from South Vietnam and Thailand into Laos, Cambodia, and North Vietnam, with contingency planning for northern Burma and China's Guangxi, Guangdong, and Yunnan provinces, plus Hainan Island. Officially, SOG would answer solely to an office in the Pentagon's high-status E-ring called SACSA, the Special Assistant for Counterinsurgency and Special Activities, a two-star general whose small staff responded only to the Joint Chiefs Operations Officer, J-3, with unprecedented direct access to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Any money SOG needed would be buried in the Navy's annual budget. Heading SOG's secret war and bearing the title Chief SOG was a World War II paratroop officer who'd come into Special Forces in the 1950s, Colonel Clyde Russell. A veteran of combat parachute jumps in France and Holland with the 82nd Airborne Division, Colonel Russell became Secretary of the Infantry School at Fort Benning, Georgia, then commanded the Europe-based 10th Special Forces Group, then the 7th Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. With O-Plan 34A, allowing no time for contemplation, Russell's Saigon staff fell back on the tried and true, and structured SOG, like the old OSS, into air and maritime sections, because these are the ways agents are transported, plus a psychological operations section similar to the OSS Morale Operations Division. The CIA offered Colonel Russell the agency's unique logistic channels for exotic hardware, such as suppressed weapons and wiretap devices, via the agency's top-secret Far East logistics base at Camp Chinen, Okinawa. Nearby was another office created by Operation Switchback, CISO, or the Counterinsurgency Support Office, which provided specialized logistics aid to SOG and Special Forces. Another CIA contribution was a clandestine C-123 transport squadron from Taiwan, flown by nationalist Chinese pilots to replace the less capable Vietnamese-flown C-47s. Known as the First Flight Detachment, these four SOG airplanes bore removable U.S. insignia and formerly had flown with nationalist China's top-secret 34th Squadron, which had been penetrating mainland China for more than a decade, inserting and resupplying agents and dropping CIA sensors. The 34th Squadron's U-2s had flown over China since 1960, spying on the Lop Nor nuclear test site and Kansu missile range. First Flight's C-123s had proved a tough target for SAMs and MiGs, penetrating the mainland 200 times. First Flight evolved from the Civil Air Transport Service, CATS, a CIA airline founded in 1949 to evacuate Chiang Kai-shek's followers to Taiwan. In 1954, CATS resupplied encircled French paratroopers at Dien Bien Phu, then in 1958 supported a coup attempt against Indonesian strongman Sukarno. CATS's thin cover side apparently became the well-known Air America, while its deep cover side became Nationalist China's 34th Squadron. Each First Flight plane had a backup U.S. Air Force crew for flights in South Vietnam. The Chinese piloted deniable missions into North Vietnam and Cambodia. Though SOG's Chinese pilots carried South Vietnamese ID cards, they spoke hardly a word of that language, and only a handful of Vietnamese officials even knew they were in the country. U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Bill Rose spent two tours with First Flight, eventually serving as its U.S. commander, and found the Chinese crews solidly professional. Another First Flight veteran, Colonel Don Radicke, admired their guts, recalling, "We had one navigator, for example, who had been shot down on the Chinese mainland 7 times and walked out every time. What could I possibly tell him about survival?" In addition to the covert Chinese squadron, the CIA turned over its 3-year-old long-term agent program, which by 1964 had airdropped 22 teams into North Vietnam. Of these, only 4 teams, Bell, Remus, Easy, and Tourbillon, plus the Singleton Ares, remained intact. At Camp Long Tron near Saigon, SOG inherited a couple of dozen agents in training whom a SOG officer found unmotivated, lacking any zeal to serve, and of generally poor, untrustworthy quality. As a SOG officer coldly confides, most trainees were not capable of going anywhere, and we had to get rid of them. At the same time, we couldn't turn them loose in South Vietnam because they'd been briefed and rebriefed on operations in North Vietnam. The solution was to do with them exactly what they had been trained and paid to do, parachute into North Vietnam. In May, June, and July 1964, they were airdropped as teams Boone, Buffalo, Lotus, and Scorpion. All were captured. The few quality agents in training reinforced the in-place teams Remus and Tourbillon. SOG began recruiting fresh agents for a 21-week training program at Camp Long Khan. It would be a slow start. O-Plan 34A perplexed Russell because deniable attacks on objectives having little military value did not make sense. "I don't feel that the objectives of O-Plan 34A were clearly spelled out," Russell later explained. "So we didn't know exactly what we were trying to do." But this was not his only problem. Each proposed O-Plan 34A operation had to weave its way between defense, state, and the White House for approval, with each stop liable to change, restrict, or delay SOG plans. Colonel Russell found this a tremendous operational handicap and complained that, "By the time we got it back, we were out of implementation time, and the restraints were too many and too frequent." Impatience was driving the program. McNamara had called for the first O-Plan 34A raid by 1 February 1964, incredibly, just 7 days after SOG's founding. Such insistence instigated perhaps the strangest episode of Vietnam's covert war. To support O-Plan 34A's hit-and-run coastal attacks, the CIA had replaced its old junks with 88-foot, high-speed Norwegian nasty-class PT boats, bringing in former Norwegian skippers to help SOG SEALs instruct the new Vietnamese crews. Developed for 47-knot runs from Norway's fjords to nip at passing Russian ships, the nasty PTFs, patrol-type fast, were light, heavily armed, and bat-out-of-hell fast, the naval cigarette boats of the 1960s. Accustomed to tiny runabouts and junks, however, the Vietnamese simply couldn't master the nasty's tricky, high-speed maneuvers. Within SOG's Naval Advisory Detachment, a dozen SEALs from Detachment Echo, SEAL Team 1, a few sailors from Boat Support Unit 1 at Coronado, California, and 5 Marine Force recon men were plenty of eager volunteers to crew the nasties for raiding the North, but political deniability absolutely precluded using Americans. Indeed, throughout the war, no SEALs ever would be allowed north of the 17th parallel. But a SOG staff officer shrewdly observed, "The Norwegians weren't Americans." However, any Caucasian at the throttles of a covert boat in Asian waters flew in the face of plausible denial. How could a Norwegian possibly explain his attacking the coast of North Vietnam? But in the rush to get the raids underway, the absurd became the acceptable. Thus, due to impatience, SOG's first covert attacks on North Vietnam would be led by Norwegians. On the night of 16 February 1964, 3 Norwegian-piloted nasties attempted to land Vietnamese frogmen to demolish a bridge, but heavy coastal fire drove them away, aborting the mission. A few nights later, another swimmer demolition was attempted, but it too failed, with 8 Sea Commando swimmers lost. By early summer, the swashbuckling Scandinavian skippers began displaying a tad too much joie de vivre for their sedate SOG superiors. As one warned, "They were getting in trouble in Da Nang, and there were definite fears in Washington circles that the whole program would be blown because these people were getting involved with Vietnamese girls and the police in Da Nang." With new urgency, Vietnamese boat crews were prepared to take over from the Scandinavians, but not before the latter got in a final few licks. By July, SOG's nasties and Sea Commandos had demolished 5 targets in North Vietnam, followed by 2 hit-and-run over-the-beach attacks on 9 and 25 July. On 30 July, SOG launched its biggest bombardment ever, employing 5 nasties against radar sites so far north they were closer to Haiphong than to Da Nang, an action SOG headquarters praised as well-executed and highly successful, with secondary explosions. 2 days later, the boat crews were resting in Da Nang when word came that North Vietnamese PT boats had attacked the U.S. destroyer Maddox in what became known as the Tonkin Gulf incident. Although he made no reference to the SOG raids, of which he was informed, President Lyndon Johnson warned Hanoi that another high seas attack would have dire consequences and ordered the destroyer Turner Joy to reinforce the Maddox. SOG Nasties bombarded another coastal radar the night of 3 August, and the next day came a second alleged clash, which became the rationale for the Congressional Tonkin Gulf Resolution and U.S. retaliatory bombing. The Rubicon had been crossed. Though conspiracy buffs and revisionist historians later would claim SOG lured the North Vietnamese into attacking the Maddox, nothing could be further from the truth. With entire regiments now headed south along an expanding Ho Chi Minh Trail, Hanoi already was committed to a widening war. A few small boat raids or destroyers passing near its coast were as nothing compared to North Vietnam's massive buildup in southern Laos. But what was happening in Laos had remained largely a mystery in 1964. In April, Defense Secretary McNamara arrived in Saigon with another of his rush orders. Out of a clear blue sky, a senior special forces officer reports, I was asked how soon I could launch operations into Laos. I tried to pin McNamara down as to what kind of operations and what the mission would be, since nobody had enlightened me or tied it into our planning that we had already submitted. McNamara insisted the Arvin must recon west of Khe San, despite the Green Beret officer's warning that unmotivated half-trained Vietnamese couldn't accomplish anything tangible without U.S. special forces leading them. McNamara agreed, but still ordered the recon missions, codenamed Project Leaping Lena, and insisted they commence within 30 days. Despite hectic training, the first Leaping Lena teams could not be inserted until 24 June. Between then and 1 July, 5 teams, each with 8 Vietnamese, parachuted into Laos. We practically had to force them on the airplane at gunpoint, a disgusted Special Forces Colonel Charlie Norton reported. Leaping Lena's results reached Presidential Advisor William Bundy in a terse report. All of the teams were located by the enemy, and only 4 survivors returned. The survivors' stories were shocked, confused, and unreliable, although they reported crossing a network of trails and roads invisible from the air, some carrying truck convoys and NVA everywhere. More months passed with no significant intelligence from southern Laos, despite telltale signs of a growing enemy presence. In early 1965, Air America pilot Jim Ryan photographed a new road from North Vietnam's Mu Ya Pass into the Laotian jungle, sheltered beneath camouflaged latticework. The war was entering an ominous new stage, with bicycles giving way to trucks, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail to a road system. On 8 March 1965, while television cameras recorded the first U.S. Marine combat troops wading ashore at Da Nang, there was a quiet celebration at SOG's Saigon headquarters. After years of inadequate intelligence, SOG at last was authorized to penetrate the Ho Chi Minh Trail, using not poorly trained, unmotivated Vietnamese, but American Green Berets. And SOG had a new chief en route to lead its secret wars, a highly respected Green Beret officer, Colonel Donald Blackburn, the legendary headhunter himself. 2. Shining Brass. New Chief SOG Colonel Donald D. Blackburn's World War II exploits had been lionized in a 1955 book, Blackburn's Headhunters, which 2 years later Hollywood turned into a motion picture, Surrender, Hell. A U.S. Army advisor in the Philippines in 1941, Blackburn and a friend, Russell Volkmann, had escaped the Bataan Death March for the mountains of northern Luzon after the Japanese forced General Douglas MacArthur out of the islands. During the Japanese occupation, Blackburn organized a clandestine spy ring and partisan training program among Filipino resistance fighters, building secret jungle camps to train Igorot tribesmen. Headhunters in the past century, his force soon was called Blackburn's Headhunters. When U.S. forces invaded Leyte in 1944, Blackburn's headhunters came out in droves to scout for the Americans, help the Air Force find Japanese targets, and rescue downed pilots. By the time Douglas MacArthur returned, the chief headhunter commanded 20,000 guerrillas and wore the eagles of a full colonel, the youngest full colonel in the U.S. Army. The 1965 assignment of Blackburn, a senior special forces officer and one of the world's foremost guerrilla experts as Chief SOG, gave the organization instant credibility, with General Westmoreland, who was eager to penetrate the mysterious Ho Chi Minh Trail complex. Nobody knew with certainty what was in Laos. Learning that would be the object of SOG's new operation, Shining Brass, which would form recon teams of tribal mercenaries led by U.S. Green Berets. To head Shining Brass, Blackburn chose Colonel Arthur D. Bull Simons, for whom Bull seemed a suitable nickname. Everything about Colonel Simons was hard-charging tough. During World War II, Bull Simons' 6th Ranger Battalion was the eyes and ears of the 11th Airborne Division and led the way ashore on Leyte in the Philippines. During the Korean War, the broad-shouldered Simons instructed trainees in hand-to-hand combat and close-quarters shooting at the Army's Ranger Training Center. And Bull Simons knew southern Laos, where he'd recruited and trained Laotian Ka tribesmen for the CIA in 1961-62. When the 1962 Geneva Accords neutralized Laos, Colonel Simons and his covert special forces trainers withdrew. While Marines began patrolling the countryside near Da Nang in the summer of 1965, and the U.S. Army's 173rd Airborne Brigade and 1st Air Cavalry Division arrived in Vietnam, SOG's Shining Brass volunteers, from the 1st Special Forces Group, secretly began training on Okinawa. By late summer, 16 volunteers were ready, exactly the number required to man 5 U.S.-led recon teams, with one man to spare. Arriving in Vietnam, the Green Berets were mated up with their teams. As Blackburn conceived it, each recon team would be a mix of 2 or 3 U.S. Special Forces troopers leading 9 local tribesmen to achieve a perfect complement of knowledge and experience. The Americans would bring a sophisticated perspective, the local mercenaries a primitive one. The Americans had advanced technology such as helicopters, and the tribesmen had ancient techniques. For example, silent ambush. And though unstated, there was another factor in team composition. Since most members of SOG recon teams were indigenous, U.S. casualties proportionally would be reduced. Initially, all SOG recon indigenous troops were Nongs, the Special Operations Gurkhas of Southeast Asia. Quite ready to let you know in a minute they weren't Vietnamese. The Nongs had emigrated to Vietnam from the southern reaches of China's Guangxi province. During the French Indochina War, the Nongs had shown themselves to be furious fighters, especially as behind-the-lines operators. The South Vietnamese regarded Nongs, as well as Montagnards and Cambodes, as inferior, and didn't even draft them. So SOG found plentiful recruits. SOGs in Dij, as they were called, were mercenaries, pure and simple, and well paid. The lowest-ranking Nong received monthly pay comparable to a South Vietnamese captain, about $60 U.S. When the always-clever Nongs learned they'd earned jump pay by submitting a parachute school diploma, forgeries came in by the droves. So SOG Sergeant Major Paul Darcy decided to call their bluff and scheduled the paper paratroopers for a jump. A lot of them showed great ignorance of how to get into a parachute, recalled Major Scotty Creerer. But by golly, they all jumped. While the Nongs and Green Berets trained, Colonel Blackburn was developing a master plan to employ them. For Phase 1, Blackburn's recon teams would explore southern Laos, identify NVA base areas and concentrations, and direct airstrikes on them. Meanwhile, SOG would recruit and train company-sized raiding units to execute lightning heliborne strikes on key enemy facilities, such as truck parks, headquarters, and materiel stockpiles, as quickly as the recon teams uncovered them. With tremendous aerial fire support, the raiding companies, or hatchet forces as Blackburn dubbed them, would land, sweep through and destroy a target, and be gone before the enemy knew what had hit him. These destruction raids would be Phase 2. Then there was Phase 3. Blackburn planned to recruit thousands of Laotian tribesmen to nip and slash the NVA at every opportunity, forcing the enemy to mass for security, thereby becoming better targets for even more airstrikes and hatchet force raids. SOG would hit and harass the enemy at every turn. But Blackburn's plan was opposed by the ambassador to Laos, William Sullivan, who severely restricted SOG's operation area to two small boxes along the South Vietnamese border, required any supporting airstrikes to launch from Thailand, and forbade helicopter insertions. SOG recon teams had to walk into Laos, though they could be extracted by helicopter in an emergency. Faced with Sullivan's restrictions, Blackburn could do little more than salute and do his best to make shining brass work. While policy disputes boiled, Blackburn was arranging the transfer to SOG of a Vietnamese Air Force helicopter unit to support cross-border reconnaissance. He obtained the Da Nang-based 219th Vietnam Air Force Helicopter Squadron, whose obsolete H-34 helicopters would become a SOG trademark. Just because it was old, that didn't make the H-34 bad. The best helicopter ever made for that, SOG operations, was the H-34, remembered Lieutenant Jim Fleming, an exceptional U.S. Air Force helicopter pilot who flew SOG Hueys. The pilot sat right on top of that big 32-cylinder radial engine, and when you went in, you at least had some iron between you and them. And it was really rough and tough and rugged. How tough? You could blow cylinders out of it and still get yourself home. Because it was a tall ship, the H-34 could hover against a hill with one wheel, and its blade wasn't as likely to hit as was a Huey's, allowing it to lift men from steeper slopes. Inside, the bottle-nosed H-34s were grungy, filthy, oily birds with exposed innards where Vietnamese mechanics had cut holes to get access to some part and never bothered to close it up. Each King Bee, as the H-34 was nicknamed, carried cases of pink hydraulic fluid and reeked of it. The overhead lines leaked it, the floors stayed slick with it. When enemy 50-caliber slugs hit its cavernous troop compartment, it sounded like a wash tub being beaten with a baseball bat. But this tub could take a lot of hits. The H-34 had only one door, on the right side, which made it relatively blind on its left, especially to the rear. For armament, a King Bee carried a single rusty World War II belt-fed 30-caliber machine gun hung from a bungee cord in the doorway, with 1,000 rounds stacked in an old can under the gunner's seat. The two most noted King Bee pilots were known as Cowboy and Mustachio. Mustachio's real name was Nguyen Van Hoang. His finely trimmed mustache gave him his nickname. Cowboy's actual name is forgotten, but his nickname arose from the Vietnamese aviator's preference for hand-tailored flight suits, usually in some odd camouflage pattern. Neither impossible ground fire nor unflyable weather stopped Cowboy and Mustachio. Dozens of SOG men survived purely because can't was not in these pilots' vocabularies. They were absolutely fearless, says Major Scotty Crerar. With the King Bees secured, SOG was ready for shining brass. In early September, Bull Simons established a modest command and control cell for shining brass in Da Nang, headed by Lieutenant Colonel Ray Call. Saigon soon began referring to Call's headquarters as C&C, and this term took hold as SOG's internal designation for the unit conducting shining brass recon. Later there would be Command and Control North, Command and Control Central, and Command and Control South. But for now, Lieutenant Colonel Call's headquarters was merely two room-sized Connex shipping containers at Da Nang Air Base. But Da Nang was far from the Laotian border, so Shining Brass needed a forward operating base, FOB, to house recon teams fuel helicopters, and launch operations. A quick map study decided it. They'd locate the FOB with a Special Forces Border Surveillance A camp at Kham Zuk, 60 miles southwest of Da Nang, only 10 miles from the Laotian border. As secluded and desolate as the adjacent Laotian wilderness, Kham Zuk sat in a bowl formed by jungled hills that held ground fog and rain for days and weeks, making the isolated camp probably the most weathered-in locale in South Vietnam. But despite weather problems, for the time being, Kham Zuk had to be the shining brass FOB. To command the FOB, Lieutenant Colonel Call appointed Charlie Norton, a well-rounded Special Forces major, a veteran of Korean War partisan experience. And to direct SOG operations there, Bull Simons recruited one of the most remarkable officers in Special Forces, Finnish-American Captain Larry Thorne. With an infectious zest for life, Thorne excelled as a scuba diver, skydiver, boxer, skier, and first-class mountain climber. Born in Finland, he'd fought the Russian invaders in the Winter War of 1940, then spent 4 years leading missions behind Russian lines. Thorne earned every medal Finland could bestow, including 3 wound medals and the Mannerheim Cross, his country's highest award, for a convoy ambush that killed 300 Russians with not one of Thorne's men lost. Aware of his superb special operations experience, former OSS chief Wild Bill Donovan personally interceded to get him U.S. residency. Now Blackburn had an all-star team. Colonel Bull Simons to head Shining Brass, Lieutenant Colonel Ray Call at CNC in Da Nang, Major Charlie Norton at Kham Zuk, and Larry Thorne to oversee the first Shining Brass insertions. SOG's first 5 American-led recon teams named for Iowa, Alaska, Idaho, Kansas, and Dakota were at Kham Zuk, finishing training. Leading each team would be a Green Beret with the code number 10, which became SOG's most prestigious title. Any man appointed at 10 had proven his judgment under life and death stress. Throughout SOG, 10s would be held in respect that verged on awe, because once on the ground, this was the man who must outwit everything the numerically superior foe could throw at his team. The 10's 2 Green Beret teammates also received numbers. The assistant team leader was the 1-1, and the radio operator was 1-2. Other team members were Hnung mercenaries, except perhaps for a South Vietnamese Special Forces lieutenant or other officer attached to gain combat recon experience. Each American also was given a personal radio code name, which soon evolved into everyday nicknames. For example, Master Sergeant Bill Grimes was called Country, while Staff Sergeant Jim Bath became Tub. Then there were Pig Pen Ambrose, Snuffy Smith, Round Eye Stevens, and so on. This kind of rank-irrelevant informality appealed to SOG's recon men. The 10 for SOG's first cross-border operation was Master Sergeant Charles Slats Petrie, and his team was RT Iowa, consisting of 7 Hnungs, 1 Arvin Lieutenant, and a 1-1, Sergeant First Class Willie Card. Lean and tall, with a genuine smile and an excellent reputation from Okinawa, Petrie wasn't flashy or fast, but as dependable an NCO as was to be found in all of Special Forces. Petrie's entire team was sterile, meaning they wore no rank or unit insignia, and even their uniforms and rucksacks were Asian-made and untraceable. They carried 9mm Swedish K submachine guns and Belgian-made Browning 9mm pistols, all of which, of course, had been acquired clandestinely, so a serial number check would lead nowhere. And for the first time since World War II's first Special Service Force was issued the V-42 Stiletto, an elite U.S. unit would have its own custom knife, an untraceable 6-inch bladed weapon designed on Okinawa by Ben Baker at CISO and manufactured clandestinely in Japan. Each was issued this unmarked SOG knife. If captured, Petrie's men were to recite a flimsy cover story that they'd stumbled into Laos while looking for a missing C-123 and had no idea they'd crossed the border. To support this fiction, SOG published special maps that shifted the border 10 kilometers west, something the worldly wise Green Berets found ridiculous. "This will buy us about 10 seconds, said Master Sergeant Billy Waugh, "because the other guys will be laughing too hard to shoot us." Petrie and RT Iowa were briefed extensively for their Shining Brass operation. Although Hanoi still denied it had a single soldier in Laos, by October 1965, its security, engineer, and logistics troops there numbered at least 30,000, not to mention an additional 4,500 men passing through each month on their way to South Vietnam. About 200 truckloads of supplies rolled down the Ho Chi Minh Trail monthly, and by the fall of 1965, the Air Force already knew the enemy had spun its 900-mile road system the length of Laos all the way to South Vietnam's Central Highlands. On 2 October 1965, fresh U-2 photos disclosed new roads in Laos, while other aerial photos showed new truck traffic. RT Iowa's objective was target D-1, only about 20 miles northwest of Cam Duc, where Laotian Highway 165 almost reached the South Vietnamese border. In the northern of two boxes, SOG was authorized to operate in. The rockets and mortars pounding the Marine and Air Force installations at Da Nang, it was suspected, came from D-1. On 18 October 1962, American newspapers were reporting the 1st Air Cavalry Division's violent clash with the NVA 66th and 33rd Regiment in the Ia Drang Valley, the first major U.S. ground combat of the war. But no one would read about the momentous top-secret doings that day at Cam Duc. Just after noon, RT Iowa's men opened their rucksacks and emptied their pockets for a final inspection to ensure they carried nothing attributable to the United States. Then, while Petrie's men test-fired their weapons, Major Norton and Captain Thorne brought the King Bee and U.S. Huey gunship pilots and a U.S. Air Force Forward Air Controller, FAC, into the operations shack to plan their insertion. RT Iowa's landing zone, LZ, would be a slash-and-burn area that looked like an old logging clear-cut from the Pacific Northwest. For thousands of years, Laotian tribesmen had practiced the primitive agricultural technique of downing trees, then burning them to fortify the soil with ash. They'd grow row crops there until they'd exhausted the nutrients, then move on and do it again, leaving a patchwork of squarish clearings at various stages of regrowth across the countryside. The plan was to insert at dusk so the enemy would have no daylight left to dispatch a reaction force or trackers, giving Petrie's men a full night's head start. If they stumbled into enemy on the LZ, the King Bees would swoop in to extract them while the Huey gunships fired miniguns and rockets. First off at 5:45 p.m. was the FAC, a tiny Cessna 01 bird dog spotter plane flown by U.S. Air Force Major Harley Piles, with a Saigon-based SOG Air Liaison Officer, U.S. Marine Corps Captain Winfield Sisson, in his back seat. Minutes later, Piles radioed that the weather was marginal, with clouds below the mountaintops and increasing ground fog. Still, he thought low-flying helicopters could weave around the worst of it. Piles called for a launch. If there was a song on anyone's mind, as the three unmarked King Bees cranked their engines, it had to be the current Johnny Rivers hit, Secret Agent Man, whose first line, "A man who leads a life of danger," so fit a Shining Brass SOG trooper. Whether 10, 11, or 12, indeed, each had been given a number and his name taken away. Not only that, Petrie and Card had turned in their dog tags, military ID cards, even their U.S. cigarettes, which were replaced by Asian brands. If they were killed and their bodies captured, the U.S. government would deny their identities. At 6 p.m., the helicopters lifted off, Cowboy in the lead chopper with Mustachio in the second bird, the third King Bee, a chase aircraft to retrieve crew and passengers if Cowboy or Mustachio or a Huey gunship went down, carried only Larry Thorne, who was not about to stay behind at Cam Duc. In his lap, he cradled a bolt-action Springfield M1903A3 rifle, an obsolete weapon in this era of AK-47s and M-16s, but he'd always gone into combat with a Finnish Mosin Nagant or German Mauser, so a bolt-action gun felt natural in Vietnam, too. As the King Bees and Thule gunships flew along from horizon to horizon, all they could see was rolling jungled hills, wild rivers, and waterfalls. The weather proved especially hazardous, forcing them to weave between thunderheads and sunbeams, avoiding sporadic 50-caliber machine gun fire. They took no hits. Then the King Bees spiraled into the appointed slash and burn, roared away, and it was done. Petrie and RT Iowa scurried into the wet jungle, all alone in the Laotian dusk. The weather worsened. Thorne sent the first two King Bees back while he orbited near the landing zone in case RT Iowa ran into trouble. Cowboy and Mustachio reported low-level visibility so bad that they climbed to 8,500 feet above the clouds and made it back to Kamzuk, followed shortly by the O-1 bird dog and the Huey gunships. Larry Thorne stayed until the team radioed that they were safe. Then Thorne radioed that he too was headed back. Larry Thorne was never seen again. In its first minutes, SOG's cross-border program already had swallowed up one of the finest officers in Special Forces and a whole King Bee. And the day wasn't over. As long shadows edged across the valley around Kamzuk, the O-1 bird dog lifted off for Da Nang with Major Piles and Captain Sisson. They, too, disappeared. In its first day, Shining Brass had generated 3 MIAs, not one of whom would ever be found. By dawn, Major Norton learned the sky had closed completely over both Kamzuk and Target D-1, with billowing clouds rising above 10,000 feet, higher than a helicopter or bird dog could fly. Beneath the overcast and drizzle, RT Iowa found Target D-1, crawling with NVA, but the enemy soldiers seemed so preoccupied with their own labors that at first the team had an easy go of it. Enemy activity was everywhere, with many little base camps and trails. On the third day, after crossing many trails and bypassing enemy voices, Petrie heard truck engines, so he maneuvered RT Iowa to investigate, and they bumped head-on into an NVA patrol. In the quick exchange of fire, Iowa's Nong Point man collapsed, mortally wounded, and the chase was on. Fighting the enemy was one thing, but the helplessness in the face of weather that shielded an aggressive enemy had Major Norton perplexed. "We couldn't get helicopters in there to get them out," he complained. Slats Petrie was carrying along the Nung's body and gear, so RT Iowa was evading slowly. The NVA fanned out, searching high and low for them. 2 days later, the weather broke, and Petrie's force struck back with a high-tech vengeance, calling in 37 sorties of F-105 Thunder Chief fighter bombers before the King Bees lifted RT Iowa out. Then Petrie went back with a FAC and called in an additional 51 sorties on targets he'd discovered, touching off numerous secondary explosions as bombs hit munitions stockpiles. The first Shining Brass operation unquestionably had been a success, yielding detailed information about the enemy and inflicting serious damage on him. The next Shining Brass target was 10 miles away, another highway terminus just beyond the border, where large numbers of enemy congregated in sanctuary and stockpiled supplies for attacks into South Vietnam. Designated Target A-1, it had wide valley floors covered with head-high elephant grass, dangerous because a team could too easily be tracked through it. Penetrating A-1 would be RT Alaska with Master Sergeant Dick Warren, 1-0, Sergeant First Class David Kauha'aha, 1-1, and Sergeant First Class Wilbur Doc Donaldson as 1-2, packing the radio. Warren was an all-business team sergeant from Okinawa. His jovial Hawaiian assistant, Kauha'aha, was mistaken for a Montagnard tribesman so often that he could not resist impersonating one for gullible strangers. And Doc was a bonus, a talented medic who volunteered to carry their radio. On 2 November 1965, RT Alaska inserted into A1 at dusk, but the enemy realized the team had landed. A stressful cat-and-mouse game followed, with RT Alaska silently bypassing and sideslipping enemy patrols. They found a network of 5-foot-wide bicycle and foot trails coming in from nearby Laotian Highway 165 and NVA patrols, lots of patrols, sweeping and searching for them. For 3 days, 10 Warren managed to bypass or hide from the enemy. But by the fourth day, there were so many enemy troops that contact was inevitable. It came in a short firefight in which Alaska bested the NVA, hitting several without any recon men being hit. Then it was a foot chase. "We kept running and running," Kauha'aha, the 1-1 recalls, "and then finally Dick and I decided to get up on the highest hill to make radio contact so we could be exfiltrated." Halfway up the steep hillside, their exhausted nongs wanted to give up. "Bullshit," Warren admonished them. "We gotta keep going." Pushing and threatening, Warren got them to the top, which they found covered with elephant grass. While Doc Donaldson hurriedly attached a long antenna and contacted a FAC, the North Vietnamese streamed up and spread out, encircling them. "They had us surrounded. Oh my God," Kauha'aha said. Donaldson got a FAC overhead, an unarmed O-1 bird dog that reported fighters en route. The NVA hesitated to come into the elephant grass after RT Alaska. What were they up to? Then smoke drifted across Alaska's position and they heard the crackling sound of burning grass. The NVA had set it afire to push them into the open. They coughed and choked and had to shift positions, but wouldn't come out. Then a pair of F-105s arrived and turned loose 20mm Vulcan cannons, but the NVA stood their ground, shooting at both the fighters and into the burning grass. Another set of fighters struck with bombs, but the NVA didn't back off. Then a lone King Bee roared right over the shooting NVA and into the burning grass, Cowboy at the throttle. "He didn't give a damn. He came in under fire and picked us up," Kauha'aha said. In 30 seconds, RT Alaska was away, not one man wounded, thanks to Cowboy. No matter what position or what situation we would be in, he would be in to pick us up, the Alaska 1-1 says. Cowboy was one of the best. Warren, the 1-0, went back with the FAC to direct 82 more fighter-bomber sorties against targets RT Alaska had located, destroying a bridge and 36 buildings, setting off 10 secondary explosions. For the second time, putting in a SOG recon man with an Air Force FAC had made a particularly effective team. Soon SOG reached an agreement with 7th Air Force, cementing this relationship. Each day, a 20th Tactical Air Support Squadron FAC, with the U.S. Air Force codename Covey, would fly over southern Laos to assist SOG. In return, SOG would detail an experienced recon man to ride with the FAC to help look for targets, select LZs, plan insertions and extracts, and stay in radio contact with recon teams. Called Covey Riders, these SOG old hands saved many lives because they understood exactly what those on the ground were going through, resulting not just in an economy of language or effective use of air support, but an unanticipated psychological dimension that was hard to explain. "I know when I was down there," recalled 10 Lowell Stevens, "just to hear a voice gave me such a degree of comfort that I don't even have the words to explain it." When a team was running for its life, pursued by hundreds of NVA, there would come a Covey Rider's reassuring voice, calm and confident, "I've got you covered, partner. TAC Air's on the way. Now, tell me what's happening." Covey Rider Lloyd O'Daniel said, "You always had to make everybody believe, including the bad guys, that you were absolutely in charge of the situation." Covey Rider ranks would read like a 1-0 who's who. Paul Darcy, Billy Waugh, Bob Sprouse, Charlie Scepter, Lowell Stevens, Larry White, Ken Carpenter, Bob Parks, Lloyd O'Daniels, Bill Grimes, and Sam Zumbrun, to name but a few. By early December 1965, recon teams Kansas and Idaho, too, had run missions out of Kamzuk. Like Arties, Alaska, and Iowa, Idaho had to fight its way out. Then Bull Simons decided it was time to shift efforts elsewhere. A few days later, on 11 December 1965, a swarm of 24 eight-engined B-52 bombers struck Laos for the first time, dumping 2,600 bombs into the area reconned by RT Iowa. Meanwhile, Shining Brass had shifted southward, adjacent to South Vietnam's Central Highlands. Launching from the airstrip at Dak Tho, the SOG teams repeated their success from November, exploring the areas around Laos and Highway 110E to discover enemy base camps and high-speed trails leading into South Vietnam. Target K-1 was a close-run thing for RT Kansas, which was hit so forcefully that the team split and two Nungs disappeared. Then, during the second operation into this small southern box, open to SOG operations, RT Idaho suffered SOG's first American ground casualty in Laos, when one Green Beret was slightly wounded. RT Idaho also lost one Nung, KIA. By the end of 1965, there had been 8 Shining Brass missions, 6 of them uncovering major North Vietnamese base camps, roads, or caches. "The more we sent teams in, the better our intelligence got," reports Major Norton. "At least we knew where the hot spots and the hot areas were, and where big ground sightings were." After each mission of about 5 or 6 days, the recon men were flown to SOG's Saigon headquarters to debrief. It was during these Saigon debriefs, lasting anywhere from a half day to several days, that at last intelligence began to learn something of how the enemy operated in Laos. The recon men explained, for example, there was no mistaking an enemy high-speed trail for an animal track or simple footpath. The North Vietnamese expertly built their trails as flat as if laid out with a mason's level, wide enough for 2 men to walk abreast, and when in use, not a twig or a leaf was to be found on its hard surface. Where an enemy trail climbed a hill, there were dugout steps and bamboo handrails so well made that they were a marvel of handicraft. Enemy roads were earthen and functional, hidden by meticulous camouflage, which made them all but invisible from the air. Instead of just bulldozing trees, as most armies would have done, the NVA engineers wound the roads around to retain as many trees as possible. Where overhead gaps appeared, they tied bunches of adjacent trees together or constructed bamboo trellises on which they'd place living plants or fresh-cut greenery. In some places, the NVA transplanted whole trees. NVA truck parks, base camps, and way stations were hewn from dense forest, and care was taken to remove only a minimal amount of natural foliage. It was always a startling experience, SOG teams reported, to be wading through dense jungle, then to step into a cathedral-like expanse beneath a ceiling of woven treetops. But the early debriefings sometimes generated resentment from recon men who'd narrowly escaped alive, only to have their information doubted, and by rear echelon non-combatants who condescendingly tried to tell them they hadn't seen what they reported. When one recon team said they'd heard tracked vehicles at night on Highway 110E, their civilian debriefer all but laughed them out of his office. "What kind of booze were you drinking up there, Sarge?" he quipped snidely. But the team got satisfaction a few days later, because an Air Force FAC flew over the area and found fresh tracked vehicle tracks. "Then they got excited about it," the assistant team leader said. The fact was, intelligence analysts didn't know anything about Laos, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, or North Vietnamese military forces. "For people down in Saigon," complained longtime recon man J.D. Bath, "if it wasn't in the book, then it couldn't be." The classic case was that of a recon team that reported a convoy of elephants carrying provisions. After a Saigon analyst mocked the returning team's report, another 10 encountered elephants and brought back incontrovertible evidence, a plastic bag full of elephant dung, which he dumped all soft and squishy on the debriefer's desk. Despite sometimes rocky relations with the debriefers, though, a lot of fresh insights flowed from the recon missions, probably the most important being a deeper understanding of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was now understood as a sort of circulatory system with its heart near Vinh, North Vietnam, from which major arteries flowed west across the mountains into Laos, then southward parallel to South Vietnam. Through these arteries, truck convoys flowed southward, then eastward along major roads that formed infiltration corridors toward the South Vietnamese frontier. As they neared the border, the roads splintered into a maze of high-speed bicycle and foot trails that, like capillaries, carried supplies and troops invisibly to the battlefields of South Vietnam. Thanks to SOG Recon, U.S. intelligence learned that the Laotian roads appeared unused because the enemy ran his convoys at night, and his trucks were so heavily camouflaged that they looked like rolling leaf piles. On overcast nights, the NVA might run 100 trucks in a convoy. On clear nights, when there was danger of air attack, they broke up into smaller convoys. It was a slow start, but the enemy's Laotian sanctuaries were yielding their long-held secrets to SOG teams. 3. First Blood. Early in 1966, Colonel Donald Blackburn's foremost concern was finding high-quality men to expand his successful Shining Brass recon.